Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Mansfield, Pennsylvania, and earned a BS degree in chemistry from the University of Maryland while becoming an All-American basketball player. A Rhodes Scholar, he was a member of the 1972 U.S. Olympic basketball team that lost a very controversial gold medal game to the Soviet Union. He served as a member of the U.S. Congress for 6 years and was recently named the CEO of the NCAA Division I Athletic Directors Association. A modern-day Renaissance man, his name, Tom McMillan. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an amazing man, Tom McMillan, who's been a Rhodes Scholar, an NBA player for 11 years, former U.S. Congressman, and now CEO of NCAA Division I Athletic Directors Association. Tom, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, it's great to be on your show. Thanks.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, I grew up in a very small town in Mansfield, Pennsylvania. My dad was a dentist. My mother went to college. My father went to college, obviously, as a dentist. And my mother, early on, was a teacher, but then she became a member of the board of trustees of our local university, a very active charity participant. So, you know, basic small-town values.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
My dad was someone that was extremely hardworking, and, you know, he just always outworked people. My mother was always the softer side. She was a good politician, so I learned some political skills from my mother.
In 1970, you're a senior in high school, and you're featured on the cover of Sports Illustrated as the best high school basketball player in the country. Tom McMillan, what was that like?
Well, from a little small town that I came from, that was pretty earth-shattering. All of a sudden, the world was upon us. The television networks, everybody was coming into this little town of Mansfield. Not an easy place to get to. Of course, all the college coaches were coming there, too, and it was just, you know, the tourism business in Mansfield went way up. But it was a lot of attention, a lot of focus. I tried to stay really attentive to where my priorities were, getting a good grades and playing basketball. But it was a big distraction, all that. But it was quite an honor to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. You know, sometimes that can be considered a curse,
yes.
But, it was really quite a singular honor to be so chosen.
Did you have any high school teachers come up to you and say, Mr. McMillan, would you sign the cover for me?
You know, I don't know. I think I had a couple classmates. They all wanted to do that. That's just natural. The funny thing is, people still send me that cover today and want me to sign it. Of course, that probably goes out on eBay,
yeah.
But I still get covers even today.
So, Tom, why did you choose the University of Maryland and the Terrapins?
Well, there were really two big reasons. I had originally committed to North Carolina verbally. I liked Dean Smith very much and had a lot of respect for him, but you know, what happened was Coach Giselle took over Maryland, and my brother had been there, played there, was going to medical school there. And, you know, I could see where Coach Giselle was really building something really from scratch. So I thought there was an opportunity to really build something as opposed to kind of perpetuating a tradition at North Carolina. But the real core reason was that my father became ill my senior year in high school, and I was concerned, you know, that he'd want to see me play, and it was a lot easier from Pennsylvania to get to Maryland, and so that was a driving factor. He actually saw me play all my home games except for my senior year when he passed away around Christmas time. So ultimately, that was the major reason.
The legendary coach Lefty Drizel, you mentioned him. Tell us about Lefty Drizel.
You know, Lefty, we're all pushing hard for him to be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he was such an innovator, you know, Midnight Madness, all the practicing, you know, starting at midnight, just the things that he did, how he recruited, and the ultimate salesman, but also a great coach. I mean, Lefty won 700-some games, and, you know, it's he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. You know, Lefty was a very caring guy. Still keep in touch with him. He really is attached to his players. He's larger than life. He has a lot of, you know, political set, you know, himself. He's just very personable. He's just, he's a bigger-than-life kind of character.
We're talking to Tom McMillan. Tom, I don't think there's been many chemistry majors who have played 11 seasons in the NBA. Why did you go with chemistry?
Well, it's a funny story. When I was in high school, my high school coach was my chemistry teacher, and I actually was pretty good at chemistry. So, you know, I had a high school coach who was a great chemistry teacher, and then I went to Maryland. I really was thinking about becoming a doctor. You know, my father was a dentist. My brother was thinking about becoming a doctor, and so chemistry was a natural curriculum, but very difficult because you have those labs in the afternoon. Oftentimes I would end up getting to practice late. Very demanding courses, and you know, there's only a handful of guys. I mean, I know Jack Maron, the old NBA star, was a chemistry major, and Danny Shays was a chemistry major. There are very few chemistry majors today. It would be almost impossible, given this college schedule, to be a chemistry major. So, you know, it's funny because my wife is a chemistry major. She's a doctor. So we have a lot of chemistry in our family. So,
hopefully there's chemistry between you and your wife. That's all that's important. So we're talking to Tom McMillan. When we come back, we'll ask him about the infamous 1972 Summer Olympics. Munich, Germany. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Tom McMillan. Tom, you represented United States as a member of the 1972 USA basketball team. First was the night of terrorism. Can you talk a little bit about that night in Munich, Germany?
Yeah, that was September 1972 when the Arab terrorists stormed the village in the middle of the night, took the Israelis hostage, and really the village became an armed camp. We woke up the next morning. We heard that the village had been stormed. You literally could walk over and see the terrorists with their ski masks on the balconies. And it was a long day because, you know, the police were everywhere, and they finally got them out of the village and tried to helicopter. Of course, that ended very tragically for the Israeli athletes. It's the first real modern terrorist attack of that magnitude. Some say it was the start of modern terrorism. To have your Olympic village so attacked that way was almost incomprehensible. And then, you know, we had to continue our business and continue to play basketball, although there was a cry to cancel the games at the time. And I probably felt that way at the time, but the truth of the matter is that if we had done that, we would have, you know, caved in to terrorists forever. And so it was probably good that the games went on. And our own games sort of culminated in a game 5 days later when we played the Soviet Union for the championship. And it was a late night game, like midnight, so that it could be televised around the world. And we were, you know, as many remember, we were a young team against literally a professional Soviet team, and we came from behind and literally went ahead at the end of the game, and then the referee started resetting the clock, and on the third time, the Soviets prevailed, and we you know, called highway robbery, and we refused to accept a silver medal, and to this day, our silver medal is sitting in a vault in Switzerland.
How do you explain the uniqueness and the magic of the Olympics every 4 years?
Well, it's a pretty amazing event. It's a spectacle. I guess my take on it might be a little different because I've been to Olympics that have been, you know, not marred by scandal or tragedy. You know, our games were very tragedy and scandal filled. You know, refereeing disputes, medal disputes, of course, the terrorism, the horrible terrorist event. So, I mean, it was a very chasing event for a young 18-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid to be in the Olympics and to see, you know, really the fallibility of it, the fact that, you know, what we think is this kind of wonderful human institution has the same fallibility as all other human institutions. And so that was kind of a wake-up call for me. But it was a great honor representing our country. People bring that game back all the time, every anniversary. So I guess this next one will be on our we'll be going to our 50th anniversary in 2022. So it's, you know, it just brings back a lot of memories.
We're talking to Tom McMillan, who delivered in 1974 the valedictorian address for his class at Maryland, and then became a Rhodes Scholar, and I believe he's the first and only University of Maryland student to ever be awarded a Rhodes. Tom, first off, what is a Rhodes Scholar?
A Rhodes Scholarship was set up by a very successful entrepreneur in the the beginning of the 20th century. His name was Cecil Rhodes. You know, they had originally a country named after him, Cecil Rhodesia. Made a lot of money, Englishmen made a lot of money in gold and diamonds and mining in South Africa, and he bequeathed this scholarship really to bring English-speaking people together at Oxford so that they could fight the world's fight and make it a better place. And it's become a very prestigious scholarship. 76 are given around the world every year, 32 in America. And, you know, it's probably one of the greatest accomplishments of my life, just to have the opportunity to go to Oxford and to meet fabulous people and to get to know many other Rhodes Scholars around the world.
You were the ninth player selected in the 1974 NBA draft. You played 11 seasons. Can you share with us a couple highlights of the NBA career, please?
Well, I had, you know, it was a lot of fun playing. You know, I played for Buffalo, which was owned by a gentleman from my hometown of Mansfield, the team, the Buffalo Braves. And I went to New York. It was great to play in New York with Bill Bradley, his last year, and Phil Jackson in the for the Knicks, the Knicks were kind of sort of on the downswing, and then I got traded to Atlanta to play with Ted Turner, and that was really such a special experience playing for Ted, as he was really, his empire was just getting ready to take off, and you know, I could see what an amazing person he was. And then, you know, I went to Ted when I was playing for Atlanta. I said, Ted, would you trade me to Washington so I could run for Congress? And by God, he did. And then I played 3 years for the Bullets, now the Wizards. And my last year, I ended up announcing for Congress before the season. So I was a candidate for Congress while I was in the NBA. No one has ever done that. And so when the season was over in May, A few months later, in November, I was elected to Congress.
You played with and against an awful lot of icons. Can you share with us a story about Magic and Larry Bird?
Well, Larry Bird was, I could give you more about Bird. I didn't really, you know, have to deal with Magic because, you know, he's a guard and I was a forward center. But Bird was always problematic because he was so skilled and probably the tough, one of the toughest guys to guard. When you went to Boston Garden, it was not a fun place back then because you've got Larry Bird, you had Cedric Maxwell, you had Robert Parrish and McHale and Rick Roby, and they had such a great group of players that, you know, if I had to pick one that I didn't want to play was Bird. He was just talented. He'd run you off screens. He was a consummate basketball player. And as I said, I don't like to go back to Boston with short pants anymore because it's painful. They had such a great team, and I always marveled because they played well together, a lot of talent, played hard. But probably one of my high points was my last year in the NBA. I was kind of starting for about 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks because of some injuries, and I had such a, you know, outstanding period. I was NBA Player of the Week. I was really on fire, and it's funny to have that happen at the end of your career. So it was a fun experience and enjoyed doing it and played for great teams, great owners, and, as I said, a lot of memories.
We're talking to Tom McMillan, who's had a very highly diversified and successful career in three very high-pressure and competitive worlds, sports, business, and politics. When we come back, we'll ask him, why'd he ever get into politics? And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Tom McMillan, who in 1987 decides to run for U.S. Congress, Maryland's 4th District. Tom, why?
Well, actually, I announced for Congress in September of 1985 because it was the beginning of my last season in the NBA. I was elected in November of 86 and then sworn in January of 1987. Why did I decide to run? Well, I had really, when I went to Oxford, I studied politics, philosophy, economics. I got away from the sciences, and I was very interested in politics. You know, when you go to Oxford, you get kind of imbued in public service and all that. And then, of course, playing for the Knicks with Bill Bradley, I saw where Bill had actually retired from the Knicks about a year and a half, 2 years later, he ran for the Senate. So I said, you know, why not? I mean, you have a lot of name identification. It's a good time for you to run because you'll fill the campaign halls. And kind of that's what I did. I thought it would be, you know, a very interesting transition. And it was. I mean, literally to go from the NBA in May to Congress in November was it was no easy task.
Tell us about those 6 years that you served, please.
Well, you know, they were great. One of the things that I remember a great deal about it was that we 4 o'clock in the afternoon, guys would go down and play basketball, and it was bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats. We called it the 4 o'clock caucus. And, you know, they don't do that anymore. I mean, it was really a chance where I became very friendly with a number of Republican congressmen that I wouldn't have been so friendly with if I hadn't played basketball with them. So it was a way to get some exercise and also build some bonds. And, you know, it was a very interesting experience. You know, serving for a period of 6 years was great. I mean, you know, 6, 8, 10 years, and you really get a full taste of government. I mean, you know, if you wanted to really stay a long time in Congress, you've got to stay, you know, 20, 30 years, which I really didn't want to do. So it was a very fulfilling. There's a lot of things that I did that, you know, speaking of college sports, one of the bills that Bill Bradman, myself, and Congressman Ed Towns passed was the Student Right to Know, where we required colleges to disclose their graduation rates of their athletes and their other students. So it became the basis for all this, you know, academic reporting today, APR and all that. So that was a very important reform. But there are lots of things that, you know, I was able to participate in that, you know, that give you a lot of satisfaction.
You mentioned the 4 p.m. caucus. Let's talk about the animosity today between the two sides. Is there hope, and what's the solution?
Well, I actually think the solution is there, you really, it's, you can do some things, but the bigger things you have to do are going to really require, you know, gerrymandering changes and campaign finance changes. The problem in Congress today is that these districts become more and more, you know, more uncompetitive. They're either Republican or Democrat, and that the only way you'll lose one of those seats is if you lose it in a primary. So that tends to push you into the corners. And that's not the way it used to be in the House. The House was filled with a lot of moderates, and today that's not the case. It's, you're either on one corner or the other. The other thing is the schedule. I mean, guys years ago used to spend a lot more time in Washington. Their families would go to school. Kind of harder to criticize someone when your kids are going to school together, but that's not the case. Guys fly in on a Tuesday and out of here on a Thursday, and there's less, you know, togetherness. And I think those are some of the things that, and of course, just the ever need to raise money has kind of corrupted the system a little bit.
Were there one or two congressmen or senators that you said, wow, this is a statesman? This is somebody I really admire.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, there were so many that, that people really served so many years. I mean, I don't want to name names, but there were, I remember there was a gentleman by the name of Bill Natcher. What a great, charming man from Kentucky who had the all-time House record for never missing a vote for 30 years. And he said, only by the grace of God were my family's funerals on weekends and things like that. Otherwise, I'd have to miss a vote. But he had this unbelievable record. As a matter of fact, they tell you as a congressman to miss a vote. You don't want to be just so crazed about never missing a vote. Anyway, well, I never missed a vote for 5 straight years. And then I missed one my 6th year. But, you know, I was always kind of admired Bill Natcher in that, you know, you go to Congress to, you know, you're supposed to be there to vote. And, you know, he was the epitome of that kind of old-style virtues that we don't see too much. But there are a lot of great people in Congress that, you know, you have tremendous admiration for them. Unfortunately, the strange thing about Congress is the sum is less than the parts. The individual members of Congress are really pretty good, but the sum seems to be less than the parts, and I think that's a real challenge.
Why is that?
I explain. I think the advent of all these talk TV shows and the amount of money that you need to have all together and gerrymandering is just a combination of factors. But I think many of the individual Congress people are very, very good. But it's, you know, it's a hard place to be these days because you spend half your time raising money.
We're talking to Tom McMillan. And in October of 2015, he became the CEO of the NCAA Division I Athletic Directors Association. Tom, what is the NCAA Division I Athletic Directors Association all about?
Well, the name is obviously confusing, and we're going through a rebranding of that right now, but the Division I-A is really all the, it's formerly known, or actually it used to be formerly known as Division I-A. It's more currently known as the FBS, which comprises all the schools that have big-time basketball, big-time football. And there's 129 of them, and we work closely with the NCAA. We also work with the schools to try to advance common legislative interests, work with them on, you know, how can we save money, how can we make money, possibly issues in Congress, all the litigation, the medical issues, concussion. There's a lot of issues in college sports, but Division I-A comprises those 129 of the sort of big time football, big time basketball programs.
We hear and see about the football and the basketball, but there's 470,000 collegiate student athletes today. Talk about the life of a student athlete in college today.
Well, and 100,000 of those are in Division I-A. I mean, it is a very demanding, much more demanding than it was when I was in school. Partly that's due to the scheduling. You know, when I was in school, we would play sort of teams proximal to us. And we'd play Navy, we'd play American University, we'd play Georgetown, we'd play GW. We'd go to Philadelphia, you know, play Villanova. And you would play these schools that you could go and play and be back that night. But these sprawling conferences have made it very difficult on the kids because there's so much travel involved. And, you know, it's extremely difficult balancing it. And, you know, that's why all this infrastructure is built up on college campuses, academic support units and all that, to try to help these kids get through. But it's extremely challenging.
We're talking to Tom McMillan, the author of Out of Bounds. When we come back, we'll ask him about that book. And I'm Jack Rasulin, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasulin. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Tom McMillan, a modern-day Renaissance man, a Rhodes Scholar, played in the NBA for 11 seasons, was a member of U.S. Congress for 6 years, representing Maryland's 4th District. And Tom, you wrote a book a while ago entitled Out of Bounds. Tell us about that book.
Well, it was a book I wrote when I was in Congress, really interweaving a lot of the experiences I had in my life in sports, but also some of the experiences I had in Congress with trying to move legislation and other relevant issues involving sports. And so, it was an interesting experience because I talked about reforming the Olympics. I talked about reforming college sports. I talked about, you know, lots of different issues in it. It was an experience writing a book. It was really the first time I had ever done that.
If there's a high school athlete or college athlete listening tonight and says, Mr. McMillan, I have to take some performance-enhancing drugs to successfully compete. I want to get a scholarship or I want to keep my scholarship. Mr. McMillan, I got to do it. What do you say?
Well, I'd say, look, you know, you cross that line and, you know, you're in a territory that, you know, can ruin your life, ruin your career. And so, unfortunately, I mean, the rules of sports right now are that that's not something that is acceptable. So you have to play down the lane and the rules that you agree to play under. And you might think that's a short-term gain, but it could be a very big long-term loss for you. And the best advice is to play by the rules.
You've recently been named the CEO of the NCAA Division I Athletic Directors Association. Tom, what changes do you see that the NCAA will enact in the next 5 years?
Well, I think one of the things they're going to do is they're going to try to put some real strong walls around time demands so that kids have protected time periods where they're not forced to play sports or whatever. I think that's going to be important one. I think that the benefit packages for athletes will become stronger. And, you know, the idea that a student-athlete, I think a lot of things that they're trying to do for student-athletes are they want to make sure that when they get through, they get a degree, but more than that, they get a job. And so I think you'll see some focus on helping these kids post-college. I mean, only 2 or 3% make it to the pros. So the vast majority of those 470,000 kids are going to have a constructive, productive life after sports. I think that's, I think that will be part of the bigger responsibility here.
It seems that politicians are always raising money, and likewise, athletic directors, there's a never-ending increase in costs for new facilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Talk about those pressures.
Well, I think that one of the issues, that's one of the issues that the NCAA is going to have to grapple with, the arms race and how to put some sanity to it. You know, even the pro leagues have figured out many times through collective bargaining, you know, that it's important that we put kind of some restraints on salaries and things like that, spending, because otherwise you're just going to end up, it's like what happens in the Soviet Union. There's a winner and then there's a loser. Ultimately, sports are about all teams being viable from a business standpoint, but the winning and losing, you know, is doesn't mean they win and lose, you know, financially as well. So I think it's I think it's going to be one of the issues that they're going to have to focus on, because it's really hard. The pressures to build bigger and better facilities is just unending. And higher ed is changing a lot. It's not going to be the same university 10 years from now that it was in our past. And so buildings and all that is going to have to be very, very critically looked at.
Speaking of which, we met, you gave a talk in L.A., a month or so ago, and you talked about the University of Southern New Hampshire, which has 3,000 students on campus and an enrollment of, I believe you said, 70,000.
That's right. Well, I think many universities are going to look like that in the future, where you have a core residential base and then you have many students who choose to take a more economical pathway to a degree, yet you can have the residential option if you want it. But, you know, education is very, very pricey for so many people. The fact is that, you know, when you end up leaving college with $250,000 of debt and no guarantee of a job, it's a world that is frightening for a lot of young students. So I think there's going to be new models of education, and how that impacts sports is going to be very interesting to watch.
You're mentioning the college students of today. They're known as Gen Zs. Those are people that were born after 1995. Talk to us about the Gen Z generation.
Well, a lot of people lump them in and say, well, they're millennials, but they're really not. The Gen Z generation is, you know, they're literally totally digital. They, you know, they don't want to necessarily, they watch a sports event on their phone. They are more conservative. They don't want to end up going to college and ending up having hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. They're more wary of their future because, you know, the American dream is not as clear to them because they see the challenges ahead. So it's an interesting group. You know, it's very important that you understand the differences between them and millennials and other generations, because these kids will be driving higher education in the next, you know, 5-10 years, and it's kind of hard to be in the middle of higher ed unless you know how these kids are thinking.
You talk to the Ohio States and the Michigans and the Notre Dames and the Alabamas, etc. You know, they sell out the stadiums, no problem. But with this home experience becoming so phenomenal, how are we going to keep these stadiums and arenas full versus just having everybody watch from home?
Well, that's why I think I talked in L.A. about what virtual reality is going to mean, not only for higher education, because you'll be able to almost feel like you're sitting in a classroom. It will be indistinguishable for you with respect to a real classroom experience, and you're sitting in your living room, or you can be sitting in your living room and literally be at the half-court line of a football or the half-court line of a basketball game. So virtual reality will change sports, will change higher education. And stadiums, you know, who knows what these things will look like years from now. It's James Michener in that book about sports he wrote, you know, 30-some years, 40 years ago, talked about you look down on Earth, you see all these sports stands. I'm sure they'll always be filled, but it could be a more challenging world or a more exciting and challenging world in the years to come.
Tom McMillan, most of us fear change and run from it. You seem to embrace it and thrive. How and why?
Well, I think change is inevitable. I mean, just think back. When I was in Congress, we didn't even use emails. Everything was done by faxes. I mean, think how fast that world's changed. Facebook and Google have only been around, you know, a decade or so. So you're talking about a world that's rapidly changing, and you have to adopt, you have to really embrace change, because there's not a lot of choices. It's coming whether you want it or not.
Tom, as our time winds down this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think the most important thing is find something that you're passionate about. You know, set high goals, you work your tail off, and don't be afraid to fail. I mean, failing is part of life. I can list my failures, and there's many, but that's just part of succeeding. Failing is part of succeeding, so if you don't fail, you'll never succeed. So that's the message that I would give them.
Tom McMillan, thanks for all you do. For the whole of America, please keep up the great work.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.